Judge Bell is, has so many people who would vote for him at this place that he gives us the best possible argument for adding an addition to this building. This is at least the third time that Judge Bell has been with us, once in a discussion that we held jointly with the law school on the place and role of the Attorney General, another time in a discussion of the Carter presidency. There actually is very little need to introduce him. In fact, he, having been here and gained such a following in this place, maybe he ought to introduce some of us to you. But just a word, everybody, I'm sure, remembers that he was Attorney General in the Carter administration from 1977 to 1979. He studied at Georgia Southwestern College and received degrees, arts and sciences and law, from Mercer University. Practiced in Savannah and Rome following his graduation from law school, and was a U.S. judge in the Fifth Circuit from 61 to 76. He's been a partner in King and Spalding, was chief of staff of Governor Vandiver's governor council and group. He was a close friend and close associate and then attorney general to Jimmy Carter. We've been having a long session this morning. I was going to say before some of you got up, but Judge Bell kindly enough came very early in the morning, and we've continued our oral history on the relationship between cabinet officers and the Carter White House with him. This morning, we thought it would be very interesting to all of us if he might speak a little bit about judicial selection. It's a great honor to have you with us again.
Thank you. Ken, thank you very much. We started 8:30 this morning, mainly answering questions, and so far we've had a nice day. Don't know how this session will come out. I've known President Carter since he was born, I guess, and we came from the same county. And he asked me to find someone to be Attorney General after he had gotten the Democratic Party nomination before he'd been elected. He told me to start thinking about it. And finally, somehow or another, I ended up being the Attorney General. I never found anybody to suit him. So my role as Attorney General was fairly narrow because he treated the Department of Justice as it should be treated, and that is, it was non-political, as he called it, a neutral zone in the government. Department of Justice has to be non-political in the sense of operating on neutral principles. Everyone's entitled to the same treatment. That's the way we tried to run it. And we've had some success at it. One of the big things that President Carter wanted to do was change the method of selecting federal judges to create some system where more people would apply, expand the universe of those applying. And he had put in a judicial selection system in Georgia when he was governor that worked well. It's still in effect. And, being copied by a number of other states. And the idea was to have a commission for the Federal Courts of Appeals judges, and the commission would pick out 3 to 5 people. And then those names would come to the Department of Justice, and we'd recommend to the president the best person on the list. We'd rate them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then in the district judges, the senators were encouraged to create commissions. Some did, some did not. But I think that worked well because I know that we've oftentimes appointed judges who had no political connections at all. Sometimes it might even be Republicans, although I once said on Meet the Press that we did not have an affirmative action program for Republicans. Most of the time, the people we appointed were not really involved in politics. They were good lawyers and had never really been active. Those kinds of people would have never been considered had we not had these commissions. Now, I thought the commissions worked well. There's been a lot of confusion because people said we found too many. We seem to concentrate on finding blacks and women. Well, there were hardly any blacks or women on the federal bench, and President Carter wanted to make the bench more representative of the American people, and we did find a number of blacks and women, but they were always people that were qualified, and we brought the bench fairly well in proportion to what our national population is. It has been said that, and incidentally, as soon as the Reagan administration got in, they did away with this commission system. They didn't like it and went back to the old ways. I'm a product of the old ways. I was appointed a federal judge myself under the old system. I was a good friend of Senator Russell, Senator Talmadge in Georgia, and also served as a campaign manager in Georgia for President John Kennedy, so that hardly any way I could have missed being a federal judge. It had nothing to do with my ability. Probably a lot of other people that qualified or more qualified than was I, but they had not had the opportunities I had. I didn't have the same set of friends that I had. I think we need to do better than that, and that was what we were trying to do. I think probably we'll go back to a system like this eventually because we'll want to get better people to apply. It's inherent in the system that if a president stays in very long, he appoints about half the federal judges because federal judges usually say it's about 15 years before they take senior status. President Carter appointed 40% of all the federal judges in the United States in just 4 years. The reason for that distortion was that we had not created any extra federal judges in a long, long time, and we added about 150 new places. That ran his percentage up. But President Reagan has, in his 8 years, 7 years, has appointed about 50% of all the federal judges in the country. So I read where columnists are commenting on that with alarm that somehow President Reagan has managed to do some terrible thing. He's appointed half the federal judges. Well, in 4 years, President Carter appointed 40% of them. And whoever's elected president this time, if he saves 8 years, will appoint about 50% again. So that's just part of the system. There's nothing wrong with that. We like this system, and the American Bar rates judges by well-qualified, unqualified, exceptionally well-qualified, and some other rating higher than that even. And I've seen a study made of the judges appointed in the administrations prior to President Carter and in the Reagan administration, and I'll ratings compared very favorably with all the others, so can't be said that the system wasn't a good system. In my judgment, I thought it was a good system. I think the White House usually, President Carter usually appointed it right off the list, and usually appointed the number one person on the list. I remember twice he appointed the number two person, but usually he appointed whoever we thought was the best person. That's just a small part of the duties of the Attorney General. I spent a lot of time doing other things besides that. In fact, I had Mike Egan, the Deputy Associate Attorney General, really ran that part of our operation. But I did read all the FBI files on every judge that was appointed. I had Mike Egan read the files, and I had a staff question on it. Mike read them, and then I read them, because we have to be very careful. You don't appoint the wrong person to a job for life. The federal judge's job is, you're appointed for life. I did a lot of work in the foreign intelligence area. Attorney General had a lot to do with that. I appeared before Congress more than 40 times during the time I was Attorney General, where Congress is interrogating you over under their oversight power. We had a legislative program to run. We had 1,200 lawyers. These lawyers virtually all selected under the honors program, which has been in effect at the department about 25 years now. And these are some of the finest civil servants we have in the government. I've often said that if you just leave the people of the Justice Department alone, it will make you look good, because they're good. They're on the equal of it. To me, it was British civil servant. I've always sought to run the British government, no matter which party is in power. These people are very loyal to their country, and are not really that interested in politics. A lot of them take no interest in politics. They're just professionals. I always oppose the special prosecutor law for that reason. I think it denigrates the department and the people there to have to go out and appoint some outside lawyer to prosecute somebody. That law was not in effect, incidentally, when I was Attorney General, and we were able to prosecute Bud Lance. Nobody thought that we weren't doing our job, or that we had to call in an extra lawyer from somewhere. We even investigated President Carter once. Appointed a special lawyer, brought him in from New York to investigate. He was a Republican, incidentally, who had been a U.S. attorney in New York, then just a practicing lawyer. And he investigated the Carter Peanut Warehouse, because there were a lot of stories that they had laundered money during the campaign. President Carter had laundered money through the warehouse to get money to run for president. And that was not true. And investigation showed it was not true. I tell that story, though, just to show that we didn't have the benefit of all these special prosecutors in, and we were able to do our duty, even as against the president. That's the kind of place the Department of Justice is. And President Carter was very supportive of the department. He had a high regard for the rule of law. He wanted the department to be as neutral as possible. He exempted me from all political activities. I never had to go to any kind of a political meeting while I was Attorney General, because he didn't think that was right for the Attorney General to be going to political meetings. That's quite a change, because Roosevelt was the president. The person who, the second term, the person who nominated him was Homer Cummings. He was the Attorney General. He went to the convention and nominated Mr. Roosevelt. That wouldn't happen today, I don't think. Maybe either party. Certainly would not have happened under President Carter. I have some strong views about the National Security Council. I used to attend some of the meetings where we discussed covert operations, but I was not always invited to the meetings. Sometimes, since I left the government, I've often wondered how I got invited. What the system was, why would he be invited sometimes and not other times. I think we would have been spared a lot of trouble in recent days if the Attorney General was required to go to the National Security Council meetings where they discuss covert operations. It would be very hard for anything illegal to be done if the Attorney General was there and had to give his or her views. That would be one thing I would do to improve the system. I found out this morning that Clark Clifford has recently come out and said the same thing. I've never discussed it with him, but it seems such an obvious safeguard to have in the government. The president's not in those meetings, you see. And he has to depend on the people that are in the meetings. If something was going to be done that was illegal, I can't imagine an attorney general who wouldn't stop it. And if he didn't stop it, then you'd go in and tell the president. And I don't believe that any president that wouldn't stop it since Watergate, maybe before that. The president might not have stopped it, but the president today has to be at pains not to do anything illegal. I think that's enough. I'll take some questions.
Thank you. Who would like to ask the first question? Henry, Theobar?
I think the looking at it entirely, at the whole operation from the outside, is the scope of the work of the department too broad? You have, on the one hand, the FBI, and on the other hand, you're selecting judges. Now, wouldn't it be better if you concentrated more on the straight legal aspect of the work rather than in the peripheral activities?
Well, that's a very good question. The first thing I would eliminate at the Department of Justice would be the Bureau of Immigration. But the Immigration Service has been in several departments. Nobody wants them. And it finally was put in the Department of Justice during World War II. It had been in the State Department, been in the Labor Department. And it's a vast agency with a lot of problems. And probably doesn't get enough attention. At least I didn't give it enough attention. The Attorney General, there's so many other things that have to be done, like the FBI and the DEA, drug enforcement. Besides the operating divisions in the department itself, where you, the Office of Legal Counsel, the Solicitor General's Office, Civil Division, where you're defending the government or bringing suits on behalf of civil suits, Criminal Division, Tax Division, all those things. So there probably is more there than can reasonably be handled. For years or for generations, we've argued whether the Attorney General will have anything to do with it, not with the selection of federal judges. Argument being that the Attorney General had more cases in court than anyone else, therefore they will not be picking the judges. But in my experience, I've not seen any judges leaning over backwards to help the Attorney General. I used to be a judge myself, so I speak from experience. And I don't know where else we would put this selection of judges. If it was in the White House, I would fear for the nation. I mean, somebody has to be as objective as possible about stopping and not getting the wrong people. A lot of times the White House owes a political favor to people. You have to understand that the White House is the center of the politics in the nation. And these judges ought to be at least screened somewhere else. And I can't think of a better place in the department. But I'd start out by spinning off the Immigration Service and sending that over to somewhere else. But no one else would want it. It's a problem. That's a very difficult area of the government to operate.
Next question.
Could you talk a little bit about this current controversy between the Department of Justice and the United Nations over the Palestinian problem?
I'm not familiar with that.
Apparently Congress passed a law that said the Palestinians had to leave the country by a date, I think yesterday, wasn't it? And they were given a 20-day grace period. The United Nations is saying that there's a treaty that they have with this country which would not permit this to happen.
Yeah, I hadn't been keeping up with that, I'm sorry to say. There's so much news about the Israeli PLO problem that I've just drowned in it almost, and I don't keep up with it as much as I should. I didn't know the Justice Department was in this, but I don't think we could tell we'd have a hard time telling the UN that they couldn't.
No, that's a treaty for doing
it. Yeah, that they couldn't let the PLO be there, I'd love to think. If it's in the treaty, I think we would have a hard time. But I don't know enough about the comment on it.
Yes, right.
What importance would you attach to trial experience in the appointment of federal judges? Now, divide that into two parts. One, of course, district judges, and the other, court of appeals judges. And I've forgotten the details, but I remember quite recently, I think it was a professor at the University of Virginia that was nominated for the court of appeals, and it was a big hullabaloo about he never tried a case.
Yeah.
And however, he was confirmed, as I recall. And he obviously was a brilliant man, and I don't know him, and I don't know much about him, except that I just assumed he was a very, very capable lawyer and would be qualified to handle any case that might come before the court.
Well, I think you need the trial experience if you're going to be a district judge. I don't think it's at all necessary to be a court of appeals judge. Or Supreme Court Justice. Justice Rutledge was, and Justice Frankfurt, I'm sure, never tried any cases. Both were good justices. This young man you're talking about, Jay Wilkinson. Yeah, Jay Wilkinson. I've read some of his opinions. He seems to be doing a good job. You wouldn't want to have, though, everyone on the Court of Appeals of the same qualifications. I think it's a good thing to have. When I was on the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, it was the largest court in the country. We had Texas back through Florida and all the civil rights cases in those days. We always enjoyed having two or three district judges who had been elevated to the Court of Appeals, and they knew a good deal more than the rest of us. I was a trial lawyer, but I was never a trial judge. And I thought a mix was good, and I think to have a professor, someone who's really learned in the law on the Court of Appeals is a good thing. It brings a flavor of scholarship that you might not otherwise get from just some rundown lawyer like me.
Next question.
Judge Bell, did you have any comments about the selection of Judge Bork as a nominee for the Supreme Court? How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm too biased to answer that question. I testified for Judge Bork.
I see.
Yeah, I thought the whole exercise was anti-intellectual myself. And he was converted the process into a plebiscite, which is whether you're for Bork or against him, you have to recognize that won't be a good thing for the future. If we're going to do that every time there's a controversy about somebody, we're going to start running polls to see whether the American people like them or not. And that is not the way the system's supposed to run. That was what I thought happened in the Bork case. I mean, when I testified there, I said that. That very day I'd read a New York Times ABC poll or some poll, and that I could see now what was happening, that they were going to start asking the American people if they wanted so-and-so to be on the Supreme Court, and they wouldn't know how to vote, but they would give their opinion, and then the Senate would follow that. And of course, all the senators said, oh, we wouldn't do that. No, we wouldn't do that. But it, Bork didn't last long after that, though.
Next question, Victor Yemke.
Judge Bell, former Chief Justice Warren Burger, had suggested on a number of occasions that the workload was too great for the Supreme Court, and seemed to suggest the possibility of a screening committee between the appellate division and the Supreme Court. Do you think that would be possible or could work?
Oh, I think it could work. I've never had a favor of that, but I think the Supreme Court justices ought to work more and use more discipline about what they do with the time. If they cut down from having four law clerks, it would be a good step in the right direction, because they've got to deal with all these law clerks, argue with them about everything. And I finally got up to three law clerks, I left. I spent all my time working with the law clerks, working for them, I thought. And they old days, the Supreme Court had as many cases as they have now, and they had one law clerk, then they got up to two and three, now they had four. And I think they need to exercise more discipline in which cases they take. I think the Justice Bugger, I don't think the system's quite as bad as Justice Bugger always contend, but that, but if we wanted to go to that system, it could be made into a workable system. What you do is call in a court of appeals judges, maybe a special assignment, 3 months, 6 months at the time, to do the screening for them. But you see, they screen now. The law clerk screen. The way the system, the way the court works, you can't even get a petition for certiorari on the conference calendar unless one justice moves to put it on the calendar. So the vast number of those 5,000 cases never even considered in a conference. So I think they're working it out. Not all of the Supreme Court justices favor doing that. Some do. I believe maybe Chief Justice Rehnquist favors it. I don't know about the others, but I think it probably ought to go along like the all while.
Every president talks about reinstating cabinet government when he comes into office, and after a while it fizzles out. A lot of power has gravitated to the White House. Do you have any recommendations or thoughts about that?
Well, that'd be impossible to have cabinet government today because a large number of the cabinet officers are no more than bureau heads. They're not, they're really not doing the same thing that the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense and Secretary of the Treasury and Attorney General are doing. They are, the Labor Department's looking after the interests of problems to help connected with labor. Conway's was looking after business problems. Housing is looking after housing, those sort of things. They don't have any responsibility for the broad problems of the nation. So I attended many cabinet meetings where President Carter would go around the table and ask people their views to report on what they were doing. And it was really a mishmash when you get into those agency type cabinet officers, and finally President Carter abandoned the idea of these cabinet meetings where everyone reported. It took him about a year and a half before he got around doing that. But you could have President Reagan's doing something a little different. He's got cabinet committees where he assigns things to fall to two or three different cabinet officers. He puts them together on a committee. You could go back, I think, to the old system that George Washington used in some of the earlier presidents, where you held maybe 4, 5, or 6 cabinet officers that serve as like an executive committee. If I was president, I think I would try that. And we'd discuss broad governmental problems, and particularly anything that might relate to several departments at the same time. And then I'd let these agency type cabinet officers either get them out of the cabinet, which would be almost impossible to do. Congress wants to add more. They're about to make another cabinet officer now. They're going to have the Veterans Administration is going to have a cabinet post. I guess you could just de-emphasize those. But right now, you couldn't have cabinet government. It'd be impossible. If it was, it'd be a terrible government. I hate to think what it'd be like if everybody in the cabinet could vote on all these things. Lincoln used to get a vote from his cabinet officers, you know. And I think a lot of the other presidents did. And I like the system where I've forgotten who the president was. Some of you may remember where he said there's 9 votes. 9 nays and 1 aye, the ayes had it. That was Lincoln. That's my system.
Other questions?
Mr. Bell, one of the things that concerned some of us, I happen to be in the medical profession, or was one. This is a this business of appointment for life. A federal judge, Supreme Court. We have the Frankfurter case in the Supreme Court. I don't know. I only know of one situation in the federal judge. Do you think that we can go on having this appointment for life?
Well, I've testified in the Congress several times that we ought to amend the Constitution to have a 15-year term for a judge. And then if you want to serve another term, you have to stand for reappointment. That would eliminate people who really weren't in shape to keep serving. I haven't found any great wave of enthusiasm for that. In fact, I've never heard anybody else say they're in favor of it, even except me.
Maybe after Senator Pepper leaves, you may be able to
test. I think it's very difficult to amend the Constitution, as you know. But I think in the years ahead, we may come to something like this. I think if you give 15 years service as a judge, you've rendered about all the service you need to render. We've gotten into shape now where we can't get anybody off the Supreme Court. You ask a question about, are they overweight? Well, I don't know. They still stay there. We've got one justice now that's 81. Three or four more than 75. And if they were overweight, I would think they'd be given some thought to leaving. You can stay, and that's the same way with the district. When I was a court of appeals judge, we had a district judge in Texas who had been appointed by Roosevelt. Now, think of that. And he would try to hold court. He was in his 90s. And the staff would pick him up and put him on the chair on the bench. And so we sent somebody to talk with him about retiring. And he said he couldn't retire. I said, President Roosevelt appointed me for life. I'm still living. Judge Davidson in Fort Worth, if you want to know who he was. He'd been the lieutenant governor of Texas. Roosevelt appointed him.
Ms. Howard Cromwell?
Well, if the Supreme Court rules that the appointment of special investigators is unconstitutional, would you care to predict what the future will be in the way of investigation of people thought to have been in violation of the law at the high stated?
Well, I don't know how the Supreme Court's going to rule, number one. I don't favor the special prosecutor law myself, but most of all, I do not favor Congress cutting constitutional corners. If there's some doubt about the constitutionality of a special prosecutor, then why have doubt? Why not do it the way it could be done legally and constitutionally? And that would be to have the president appoint a number of special counsel, have a panel, and they could be saved on into another administration. Those people on that list would be all confirmed by the Senate. Then that would be legal. That's what the Constitution said. And why Congress insists on not doing that is beyond me. Then we'd have prosecutors who have been confirmed by the Senate. The second thing about the special prosecutor law that I object to is that the public doesn't know what that charter is. These judges sign these orders and tell them what they're supposed to do. We don't know what that is. There's two special prosecutors right now who are secret. Can you imagine having a secret prosecutor in a free country? Now, this kind of thing to me won't do. And we'll finally come to our senses. But I would think that just what I've described, if the law is held unconstitutional, that the American people have been told that they can't trust the Department of Justice to prosecute anybody, and we've got to have these special prosecutors, then we'll have a panel of them. they'll be nominated just like a U.S. attorney or attorney general, and confirmed by the Senate. At least then we know who they are, and know that they've been investigated by the FBI, and they've been checked to see if they paid the taxes, just like a prosecutor has to be, or a judge, and we'll have more confidence in them. At least I will. I don't like the system we have now. I don't think it's anti-democratic. It's a reaction, overreaction to me. But this is, right now, the Justice Department's having a lot of trouble. And we had some popular attorney general right now. People would probably pay more attention to what I'm saying. Right now, people say, well, the attorney general's on the investigation. Well, it might be, but that's not the way the system works. If it's something he's had dealings in, he can't handle it anyway. It has to go down the line until you find somebody that is qualified to handle it. In the Bert Lance case, I disqualified myself, but it passed down to, it got down to the some career people. And they handled the whole thing, indicted him, prosecuted, tried it, and that's the way the system works. So people will be prosecuted. You don't have to, problem we have in this country, we prosecute too many people, it seems like, sometimes. Not many people are getting off.
Ms. Curry.
Judge Bell, do you think there's more and more difficulty in keeping a separation of powers in the country? It seems like there's been more infringement upon the rights of executive branch by the legislative branch in more recently.
Oh yes, that's gotten to be quite a problem, and particularly in foreign policy. We are seeing something that in Nicaragua with the Speaker of the House intervening directly there in the foreign policy that I didn't think I'd ever see. And people are not outraged over it. It's quite a surprise to me that writers are not writing much about it. It's a direct conflict with the Constitution, with the system. And it makes it impossible for the President to carry out, execute the foreign policy, fashion it and execute it. And it's the President that's accountable on our system for doing it right or wrong. But now we got two groups running. We got the President running, we got the House running. Senate hadn't been in yet. If they get in, we'll have three people.
Would the Supreme Court or court system have any recourse?
No, the court wouldn't handle it because it's a political question. They are. A lot of these questions that was the legality of the Vietnam War, that was taken to the Supreme Court several times, but they never would handle it on the grounds of the political question. I had to defend a suit brought by Senator Goldwater when we abrogated a treaty with Taiwan after we recognized the People's Republic of China. And that we won that case on the ground that was a political question. There are a number of suits pending in Washington right now brought by members of Congress trying to get things done that President Reagan won't agree to, and they'll all be thrown out as political questions. So we just have to leave some things to the voters. And maybe in the long run, maybe it'll straighten out, but it's a worrisome thing to me right now.
Professor Fernbach.
Judge Bell, from what you've said, I gather you believe that very much depends on the President as to whether the Attorney General's office functions more politically or more neutrally in terms of politics. I agree with that. You also indicate that Supreme Court justices might do better if there were less law clerks available, because law clerks have very little experience with the law and actual administration. I wonder whether you
can... I'm sorry I said that in retrospect, because I'm never going to win another case.
I have a feeling you have some more reforms up your sleeve. Would you, for example, be for institutionalizing the commission system of nomination? What other reforms have you in mind? Because this is vital to us.
Well, that would be one thing I'd do, is these commissions. I would do that. I would depoliticize the selection of judges. I would prohibit the Justice Department from asking people questions about their philosophy. Mm-hmm. I think that's an abomination to be doing that. We never ask anybody any questions when I was attorney general about their philosophy. Absolutely improper in my judgment to do that. So I would stop that. The other thing that I think would improve the Department of Justice, that's all really I know much about, would be take the patronage away from senators for appointing U.S. attorneys. Mm-hmm. Let the attorney general pick the U.S. attorneys subject to presidential approval, which you always have to get, and confirmation by the Senate. And then the other one I mentioned already, I would have the Attorney General attend all meetings of the National Security Council. Somebody, maybe the deputy, if the Attorney General can't be there every time. Just as the Secretary of Defense comes or sends the deputy, Secretary of State comes or sends the deputy. They're always there, but not the Attorney General. So there's a number of little things like that. None of them drastic. All of them could be done by a president, but the problem is something the next president changes. There's another system in on it. We were talking this morning. I have a feeling that maybe the presidents don't understand enough about the government. We get people in as president, and maybe they haven't studied the system much.
You run against it.
Well, I received a letter from Governor Dukakis asking me to support him, and he sent a copy of one of his speeches. So I read the speech, and he called on every American to write a letter to speak of Wright, Jim Wright, and thank him for what he had done to help the situation in Nicaragua. Well, you know, he needs to know more about the system, and the allocation of power under the Constitution. He probably, just an intuitive judgment, maybe he thought that was a good thing without thinking about this, making the system work right.
Other question, Helen Hamilton.
More than one government agency is involved in a war on drugs. Would you care to comment on the Attorney General's role in the current war on drugs?
Well, the Attorney General ought to be the leader in the government, and that because the FBI and the Drug Enforcement Administration are under the Attorney General. Now, the FBI does very little work on drugs. Traditionally, starting with Director Hoover, he did not want the FBI working on drug problem because he said it might corrupt some of the agents. Of course, when he lived, we didn't have a drug problem. We have one terrible drug problem now. But you have to use the Coast Guard. You have to get some help from the military, the rest of the military, which is called Coast Guard military. And that was slow in coming. But we can keep track of airplanes, ships, and somehow or another we are not interdicting as much to the degree we ought to be. A lot is going to have to be done in other countries, though, to dry up the sources. We had good luck with Mexico when I was Attorney General because their national policy are very much opposed to marijuana. They think it had a bad effect on their people. And so they helped us. They destroyed the poppy fields. We, at that time, not cocaine hadn't come on the scene much. It was heroin. They were very cooperative. But I believe in the end, the only way we're going to do anything about the drug problem is to mount some sort of a national campaign against using drugs. If we don't stop the use of drugs, it's hard to keep people out of the market. We have apparently the largest drug market in the world. And there's a lot of money to be made. Prosecute these pilots, they get some form of military pilot, get $25,000 cash up front to fly one flight to Columbia and $25,000 when he gets back. Tax-free money. Or you can pay taxes on it, you'd still be pretty well off. That's the kind of money it's in for little people. Think what the people that run it make. So I think maybe we have to go do more about the users to dry up the market. And that would be something the president would have to do, I think.
How would you do that?
Just use the office of president as a pulpit. And what Ted Roosevelt called a bully pulpit, get people fired up on it. Get it organized on state. And there's hardly anything that we shouldn't do to stop it. But we're not getting it stopped now. The drug problem is a terrible problem. I was talking to a client recently in Atlanta who had a mill in about 50 miles from Atlanta. And it was a place where he said they'd always tried to operate having about 70% white employees and 30% black, because that's kind of a population they had there in this little rural county. And he said they couldn't hire white people, that they all failing the drug test. And the number of blacks was creeping up. They were getting out of balance, which is not a bad thing. I mean, no reason to get excited, but he was really appalled at the number of people that couldn't pass a drug test who wanted a job. Well, that's just in one little town. And I've talked to people that run corporations, and they say this is happening all over the country. And then we don't test people on the job. This is people applying for a job. There's no telling how many people we had to fire if we started testing on the job. So this is a massive problem. Hadn't been talked about enough. Probably in this little town where this mill is, there in Georgia, it's a beautiful town, people would be outraged. Somebody said that about their community. But there are these tests that show up. It's a big problem, yeah.
The problem you've got there, though, if you let someone go or try to let someone go that has a drug problem or an alcohol problem, then the workman's compensation, I don't mean workman's comp, but the unemployment compensation comes back and says you can't let them go because they're sick.
Yeah. And you've got
what do you do about that?
Discrimination suit. Well, these people that, these tests I'm talking about are for people that are trying to get a job. So you don't have to give them a job. And that's about all you... I think there's a case in the Supreme Court right now on this, where maybe public employees were tested, and some judge ruled it. I think a district judge ruled it couldn't test public employees. Some court appeals reversed that, and I think that may be in the Supreme Court now. And I don't know what the public employees were, whether air controllers or what, but we'll be seeing more and more of this in the future. This will become a big battle. It's, too bad to run in and test everybody every day, but if you've got some reason to think people are using drugs on the job, it seems to me you can get up some sort of a reasonable sampling system. But I don't know how that'll work out. We'll just have to wait and see what the Supreme Court does about that. There's something wrong back there.
Other question, Mrs. Cromwell?
Yes. Judge Bell, when there is a new administration, how is the transition process managed as far as the department is concerned?
I'm not familiar with any transition process except the one we used in the Carter administration. And we had a young man in our law firm named Jack Watson, who after President Carter got the nomination, before the general election, President Carter asked him to set up a transition team. And he assembled 10 or 12 lawyers mainly, not all lawyers. And they started trying to find out what jobs would be need to be filled, and start getting lists of people. And I thought did a good job. In fact, I got some of their lists when I was looking at the people at the Department of Justice and looked at some of the people they had. I would imagine all the candidates do about the same thing. There are a lot of people that would like to come into the government. You can't get as many as you good people as you want, but there's a lot of people. We're a very patriotic country. And if you'll ask the people to come into government, particularly if the president asks them, they find it hard to turn it down. Now, it's more difficult now because we have all these disclosure rules. A lot of people won't want to disclose that they have a lot of money or that they don't have any money. It works both ways. And then a lot of people just resent the fact that you're invading their privacy by asking all these things. I was had made my mind up that I'd never go back into government again. And when I left the Attorney General's office, after going through 2 weeks of hearings in the Senate, I just didn't ever want to have to do that again. President Carter called me and asked me to go to Madrid to be head of the American delegation to this Helsinki Accord, the follow-up meeting. And I agreed to do it, and I got a set of forms to fill out from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, from the White House, from the somebody else. I had three sets of forms filled out, so I sent them all back and called President Carter and told him I couldn't do it. I just wasn't going to fill out all these forms again. And be embarrassed about all the things they wanted and have a hearing. So he called Warren Christopher. Vance was out of the country somewhere. Told Warren to figure out a way to get me appointed as a special ambassador without having to fill out any forms. So I was appointed a special ambassador for 6 months. And I didn't fill out form one. So, worked all right.
Have you found a way to apply that to your income tax?
No. When I left Washington, Chief Justice Berger asked me what my next ambition was. I said to become one of the largest taxpayers of the nation. I happened to see him last year, and he asked me how I was coming. I said, I've paid all the tax I want to pay him. I'm tired of paying.
May I ask a follow-up to Mrs. Cromwell's question? We've had a commission, you may know, looking at presidential transitions, and it's had a forthcoming report that's been forthcoming for about 8 or 9 months. They think they'd have greater impact closer to the time of at least the choice of the nominees. There have been, Senator Glenn's Government Operations Committee has looked at transitions, and there have been some other groups. Their recommendations go in one direction. Our recommendations, if I can just anticipate for on a detail, ours go the other way. They want to increase from 2 to 3 million the budget for the transition group. We want to cut the money because hairdressers and tuxedos and all these things have been paid for recently with the transition expenses. Do you have any thought about the size of transition operation? Yours was not one of the larger ones, I don't think.
No, I really don't. I think you ought to, basically, I don't think you ought to throw money at every problem. I don't know if we had any money to do the transition in the Carter administration to begin with. When Jack started working on it, we didn't have any money. And in fact, until now, I didn't know we ever got money from the government for that.
I think you got some.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, it's not, it couldn't be that hard to handle a transition. First, you need the list of all the jobs you're going to fill. And if you fill the top two or three layers of jobs, then those people can find other people. Then I found people that, at the Justice Department that transition never heard of myself, because I knew where good people were. But there's a lot of, I think we need a transition, but I can't imagine increasing more money. If we had $2 million, that ought to be more than adequate. It's a lot of money just to do a personnel operation.
Any final questions? When, many of you may remember this, when President-elect Carter introduced Griffin Bell as Attorney General, and there were some reporters that were standing around or in the ante rooms snickering about disappointment. Why, President Carter prophesied that he would be one of our great Attorney Generals. I've often wondered about the snickering. Maybe it was Georgia Southwestern. We had an applicant and judge in graduate school from Georgia Southern, and somebody said, how can he be in the graduate school here? Well, he's either number one or number two in our graduate student group now in government foreign affairs, so he did pretty well. I noticed the same thing when people said, well, he graduated from a little college in South Dakota, about me. Maybe it's the word South that throws some people off, but whatever the original reaction was, what is so striking is that at the end of his period, people had begun referring pretty consistently to Judge Bell as one of our great attorney generals. I think some of the reasons have been apparent this morning, and I think the fourth time that he comes to visit us will be even better. So we all look forward to continued relationships with you, Judge.
Thank you.